This information is subject to a disclaimer at the end of this podcast. Please ensure you listen to the disclaimer and go to www.ubs.com for further information about UBS.
Welcome. At UBS, we do our best to give you our most well-thought-out, rigorous research, but we're also very privileged to speak to some of the finest minds in the markets who are our clients, and we learn a lot from them. We have presented these conversations to you in the past. We've spoken with Mohammed El Arian, who's president of Cambridge Queen's College and also the chief economic advisor of Allianz. We've spoken with Jeff Grunlock, CIO of Double Line, and we've spoken with Dan Iverson, CIO of PIMCO. Continuing with that tradition, today we are speaking with Sonia Lard, CIO of Legal & General Investment Management. Sonia, thanks very much for making the time. It's a real pleasure to speak to you. There are some signs that the US consumer and the US economy is beginning to slow down, whereas the rest of the world, Europe and China, are beginning to show some stabilization in the data, in Europe's case, even some improvement. Do you believe in this idea of rebalancing away from US exceptionalism towards better growth in the rest of the world?
Thank you very much for having me to start off with. And you've summarized it quite neatly, because what is important to understand is that all these three regions have different starting points and had very, very different journeys throughout the pandemic and the immediate aftermath. And that is when the cycle desynchronized. And that is important to understand, because until then, we had actually a relatively synchronized global economic journey. If you now think about the US to start with, it's very clear they have had the biggest fiscal impact post-pandemic. It was very even still during the pandemic, meaning that most governments were very happy to support, and of course for the right reasons. And as such, during the pandemic, it was similar. What changed is that Europe stopped and the US continued. That explains actually quite a large part of the different growth profile that we have seen emerge post-pandemic. And hence the idea of the exceptionalism, where we have to question if it is, of course, mostly based on fiscal stimulus, how sustainable is it? Now, on the other hand, Europe had a very different journey post-pandemic. And as you rightly said, from a very low base, now we see the first green shoots that we might actually see an improvement. Whereas, of course, for the US, we are now seeing that interest rates, of course, do have some impact. When we then look at China, this is even a different story again. What has been unfolding ever since is a balance sheet recession on the back, of course, of multi-decade overinvestment in property, and hence, again, a very different economic cycle. And for them actually to stabilize, I think, would be a good step forward. Now, where from here? The importance will come down how particularly fiscal policy will develop from here. Our expectation is that, as you rightly said, we will see a mild slowdown. This is consumption-led, and of course, I'm sure we will talk about politics in a minute, because it's very important how this will develop going forward.
Right. So then, talking specifically about the US economy, how would you characterize this slowdown? So it seems to me, based on your comments, that we can put aside this idea of no landing, that growth and inflation will continue to accelerate. So there's going to be some form of landing. Would you call it a soft landing or something more sinister than that? I'm assuming you're not calling for a recession, but between soft landing and something weaker than that, where do you sit in that spectrum?
So to start with, the consensus clearly believes in the soft landing narrative. And that is important, because when you look at the market and how the market has reacted to it, that is all but priced. And the soft landing, of course, implies that we only see a mild slowdown followed by a reacceleration and inflation continuing to target. We have been focusing predominantly on where the weakest links are in that narrative. And to start with, we have to acknowledge that soft landings are incredibly difficult to pull off. What we're seeing right now is monetary policy and fiscal policy working against each other, because monetary policy is trying to slow down the economy, whereas fiscal policy is trying to stimulate it. We are end of cycle, and so this balancing act will continue. So we have been watching consumers, how do they react. We are watching default rates. We're watching all those early indicators where the stresses emerge in the economy. For the time being, we're worried about the narrowness of the path that has been put forward by most of the consensus, and where the weakest links are, because this will have reasonably big implications on markets if we consider where valuation levels are right now.
2024 is a year of elections. Through the year, we've got about 74 elections, and including the European parliamentary elections, about 4 billion people are going to be voting, so more than half of the world's population. No election is more consequential than the US election. We've just come out of the first presidential debate in the US. Do you think the markets are already pricing in a Trump victory?
No. I don't think the market has priced any of the potential outcomes. And I would think it's too early as well, because as you just said, we've just had the first presidential debate. We haven't even had the convention yet. So I think there's a pathway. And if you look back in history, I think the chances hence of a clean sweep might be higher than what the market is currently pricing. And that's the interesting facet that I think we should focus a lot more on, because a potential clean sweep has far more reaching consequences than, of course, a split government.
So please tell us, I mean, how do you think that will change if we get a red wave, if the White House, the Senate, and the House are Republican? What does that do to assets? What does that do to the economy?
So what we know so far is, point one, interestingly, both parties are actually relatively aligned when it comes to fiscal policy. But what we do know on the basis of what the Republicans and Trump have told us so far, they will probably extend and go beyond the fiscal measures that are already in place. We know the Trump tax cuts that were implemented during his first presidency most likely will be renewed if it's a clean sweep. There will be further support for the Inflation Reduction Act, and there's other measures they have put forward. What we have to assume is that a Republican clean sweep is inflationary. That's where the market comes in, because the whole narrative around rate cuts, of course, would be challenged if that's the case. So far, that's not priced. The assumptions still are for rate cuts potentially to start this year, but clearly to go through 2025. If we have a Republican clean sweep, and assuming that, of course, they will follow through with what we've heard in the campaign, that will be inflationary. If the Fed cannot cut rates, then the bond market will take note, because that means the short end is pretty anchored. But then we come to the question of fiscal sustainability, deficits, overall debt levels. If we assume that the US then has to finance this at far higher rates, expectation as they stand means that interest cost will double over the next couple of years. And that is a meaningful amount of money that the market will take note and will question whether this is a sustainable policy path or not. And considering that there's no term premium right now, we have to assume that the bond market will take note eventually, and that you might see the steepening, not because the short end is coming down, but the long end is moving.
Will the bond market move enough to scare the equity market, or will equities do better because you're expecting, it seems to me, better nominal growth, because you're saying inflation is going to pick up, also very strong fiscal stimulus, continued and strengthening fiscal stimulus from the Republicans. So that means higher nominal growth. Higher nominal growth is something that equities really like. Higher bond yields is something equities really dislike. How do we balance this?
That is a really, really good question, and will actually be at the crux how to position in markets. I would assume that initially the reaction is positive, because of course the bond market might well wait until we have the actual result, and as such it will take some time before the evidence is feeding through. But you're absolutely right. What will be taken negatively clearly is when there's more evidence that the Fed cannot cut rates. Right, because that was the premise that led to rallying equity markets, because of the backdrop of lower interest rates. But secondly, then, if we really do see term premium being priced back in and the long end of the bond market really moving, I would imagine that the equity market will react badly, particularly if we see that the expectations probably are already quite elevated. And what we might be seeing is that actually we're now seeing the evidence supporting those expectations, which means you have a balancing act, which again, we're talking about an index level here. There will be great nuances. And I think actually the asymmetry that we might see is the bigger opportunity, rather than judging whether the headline index level will go up or down. It will be the asymmetry, because we know, of course, fiscal policy is not evenly applied. So there will be favorites, and there will be sectors that will probably benefit a lot more than others.
So still talking about the Republican sweep, then what are these sectors or industries that would be preferred relative to the others?
If you think about the beneficiaries so far, there of course has to be the understanding that there will be a continuation. So the Inflation Reduction Act has been incredibly successful to really put the money to work very quickly. Energy transition is a topic, again, this is not just the US, but clearly has been very much in favor. AI and the technology sector has been a beneficiary and probably will strive even more in that environment. And I believe the AI theme in particular might definitely move to the implementation phase rather than to the creation phase. And same for energy transition, you might find a really opportune situations where you have the enablers rather than just the implementers. There's a lot of innovation ongoing, which is, I believe, a great opportunity to invest in.
Sonia, what if we don't get a Republican sweep? If we get either a split Congress or a Democrat presidency, does that significantly change your mind?
So again, it's the clean sweep ends that are most interesting, because even a Democratic sweep, we believe, is mildly inflationary. They are not as clear in their fiscal policies, in that there's a few question marks in terms of the Trump tax cuts. You know, we assume they would probably not renew them, but given that the candidate question is still out in the open, we probably have to be a bit more careful what we do interpret into this. But what we do know is, and this is what I said earlier, they are probably most aligned on fiscal policy than on everything else. So both clean sweeps would be inflationary, but with a far higher certainty on the Republican side compared to the Democrats. Split government is a bit more what we have seen before, less focus really on structural reform. Very difficult to see the debt ceiling debate coming back up. The question of fiscal sustainability surely will come up. And of course, the overall debt levels. Again, fiscal policy will remain supportive, but you probably will have a more open debate on fiscal sustainability.
Okay, very interesting. Difficult to talk about the future given how uncertain it is, more than usual because of the politics. But given what we know about the economy, given what we know about earnings, if we leave the politics aside for just one second and the geopolitics aside, how do you think about equities? Do you think they give you tremendous value even at these levels or not?
Are we in a bubble? No, we don't think so, because earnings growth, particularly in those names, has been formidable. What is interesting as well is because there have been comparisons to the late 90s, it's very much a US situation. There's nowhere near similar, you know, exaggerations that we can see. And as such, it is important to look beyond the headline level, because we know the S&P 493 has done significantly less well than the S&P 500. And it's important for investors to be aware of this, because valuation levels, earnings growth, of course, as well, is all a lot more moderate. And so it will come down to understand where the potential impetus and trigger will come from to change this. We are getting more interest in a more equal-weighted S&P rather than taking the concentration risk. So supporting, of course, the view that technology is still very attractive, but that overall the concentration risk is too high. Valuations are elevated. There's you can look at it from various angles, and valuations are elevated. And earnings expectations are ahead of what the fundamentals are telling you. Again, that tells you that the potential asymmetry on the downside is elevated. Currently, we are underweight risk, but we are expressing it through credit rather than equities.
So valuations are a problem, both in equities and in credit. It doesn't necessarily mean that high valuations lead to a sort of a collapse in the market today. You're expressing your worry through credit, which makes it sound like you're more neutral on equities.
Yes.
Can I ask you, where is that different across regions? So the US coming down from grace from a very high level, the rest of the world more optimistic on, is that a fair comment? I mean, are you more positive on European or Asian equities relative to the US at this minute?
Yes, absolutely. You've summarized it very well. Given the different starting points, the different expected trajectory in terms of growth, we currently would have a preference for Europe over the US. We do have exposure to technology still, because we believe this is such a dominant theme that you want to not necessarily have the overweight to the US, but not lose out on what still is an incredibly strong trend. Acknowledging the valuations, but as I said, short term, they might not tell you very much.
So you're long technology, but not necessarily chasing Magnificent Seven, which means you're long technology, other stocks in the US, to the extent that there's technology in Europe, but also I assume Asia, you're long technology there. That's very interesting. Just one last question on equities then, Sonia. You spoke about medium-term returns, and you spoke about how valuations may not be relevant for returns over the next 1 week, but over the next 2 years, they are quite relevant. We've had 14.8% CAGR in terms of total returns over the last 15 years. That's spectacular returns in the last 15 years. A lot of it, many people would say, driven by valuations rather than earnings. How do you see this in the medium term if we were to make predictions for the next 15 years? Really difficult. But do you think we can repeat this? Do you think we can pull another rabbit out of the hat? 15% returns annualized over the next 15 years?
Not without external help. The external help over the past 15 years was extraordinary loose monetary policy. Assuming that this will not repeat itself, and it's an assumption, and we can look into this, then we will lose that stimulus and that help. So what else could replace monetary policy? Of course, a continuation of fiscal support and potentially a level of productivity growth that some forecast AI can bring.
Fiscal policy and monetary policy are unlikely to give us the kind of support that they give us in the last 15 years, which really comes down to this other fantastic point that you made, which is productivity. Are you a believer that we are just ahead of a major productivity pickup? And what gives you that confidence, if so?
So I do definitely believe that AI has the potential to significantly change the productivity profile. The debate, of course, is around timing. And in the context of what we've just discussed, is it 2, 5, 10 years? And I think there, even in the rounds of the experts in San Francisco, I hear there's great debates on how quickly the revolution will happen. So we're more cautious probably than what we hear elsewhere, but we are definitely supporting the notion that it will be a positive driver for productivity. We're not quite as sure on the actual timing on when this will happen.
Sonia, let's talk about fixed income, so both rates and FX, and we have to start talking about inflation first. Do you think inflation has structurally changed compared to the pre-COVID era?
Yes, for a number of reasons. And the one actually is, and probably the most important one, is linked to the geopolitical situation. If we assume that what we're currently seeing is the starting point of a multi-year, decade-long journey towards a multipolar world with significant shifts in the overall setup of the global world order, then we have to assume that globalization has not only reached its peak, but that it will unravel to some extent. Again, the magnitude is difficult to forecast, but that assumption in and of itself implies an inflationary upward pressure, because we will have to reconsider global supply chains, and we will have to, as companies, have a look at how we produce and how we sell our products. The second is energy transition, which again, in and of itself, we believe not only triggers a lot of investment, but will lead to a level of inflationary pressures.
Very, very interesting. Let's talk about what this means for policy, what this means for markets. What are you expecting from the Fed this year and in 2025?
This year is really interesting because of the election. And I know the data has now been more supportive, but of course this is again just one data point after a series of actually higher than expected data points. And as such, I'm still wondering whether the likelihood is for no cut this year, and then to see how the market backdrop, growth and inflation will continue. You rightly pointed out that, of course, we are seeing weakness appearing, which would be supportive to at least get one cut in ahead of the election.
September.
Right, yeah, otherwise October, this is too close, even for Jay Powell's liking. Yes. And I think it's better for the Fed to stay well clear of that election cycle. But you know, he will want to make sure that he has real evidence that the economy indeed is slowing to the extent they expected. Because I'm pretty sure the last thing the Fed wants is to put the hike, the cut in September, only to see the data reaccelerating and potentially forcing them to turn around and hike next year. That might be the extreme, but you see what I mean. And I believe that unless they really have the evidence and the data, they might well just say, we can wait and see, because they currently, of course, expect a soft landing. So there's no real need to cut rates.
So the market's pricing in 1.5 cuts this year. You think one cut, if that, there's a good chance also of no cuts. The market's pricing in 4 cuts next year. Would you disagree with that?
If we have a Republican clean sweep, yes. I think that would be too optimistic, unless they change completely their stance on fiscal policy. And that's the difficulty, right? Because for investors to position yourself, you need to take a view on the election. And I'm not sure how many really would like to do this. Of course, the closer we come to the election, and you will see that the policy swings until then, although we've had enough evidence again, you shouldn't read too much into polls, because they have been well wrong again in a number of cases. But it is, you know, you have to take a stance, because the outcome might be very different, as we said, particularly when you have a split government compared to a clean sweep. And that will determine, we believe, how markets will react to it, and hence your opportunity set for next year. Because if we don't get those cuts, that is a very different narrative for markets and will be reflected both in equities and bond and credit markets.
Right. So it seems to me you're saying 2024, 2025, you'd probably be a little more conservative than the market. Of course, a lot depends on politics. I completely understand that. But if we're not that enamored by the front end, and the curve is already as inverted as it is, negative 49 basis points as we speak on 2 stands, and you think the term premium really should pick up because of geopolitics, in that case, are we also saying that there's not much value in duration?
Again, in the US, we probably will look for the steepener as the better trade. Right. We're looking for duration elsewhere.
Right.
And this is the beauty, right? With a more desynchronized cycle, you can really look for a well-diversified portfolio, bringing me back to how you can think about this, because the journey will not be the same.
Right. And which markets do you think you'd rather be buying fixed income in?
So, of course, in the context of duration, we believe Europe, again, is probably the better market to look at, because it is a clearer path. Now, whether the ECB can follow through with all the cuts they had in mind, because they will be very mindful if the Fed cannot go ahead, that the interest rate differential, of course, will open up to an extent they might feel uncomfortable with. But for the time being, it's the clearer narrative. And even if you now look at French politics and the European election, still what we're seeing in terms of the fundamentals gives them, I think, enough comfort to follow through. So it's a cleaner version of the story, and not as distorted as what we might see in the US because of the election that will happen in November.
So European bonds are your favorite amongst a global portfolio right now?
Spreads are not as tight either, because all reflected in the expectations and the idea of the exceptionalism that the US has carried with it.
Right. You mentioned earlier that you are cautious on valuations, but you're expressing it through credit. What in credit worries you?
So if you look at high yield spreads, if you look at US investment grade, they are close to all-time tights. And I know it's been an incredibly stable asset class since the beginning of the year. We had new issues. So it is well functioning. So we do not expect any disaster. But of course, if you look at the opportunity set and the risk return profiles, we feel that we do acknowledge that investors have shifted from being spread obsessed to looking at the absolute yield. And as such, of course, everything now looks great, because having been through a cycle where we had 16 trillion of outstanding bonds globally with negative yields, everything feels like heaven. And as such, we fully understand this, and you might well just sit there and say, okay, I clip the coupon and I ignore the spread risk for the time being. But if we just look at it to say, okay, are we compensated for the risk that we're taking? And, you know, we've talked about the slight deterioration, small cracks appearing, default rates rising, and spreads haven't really reacted to it yet. So it might well come down to the asymmetry, if you have an external shock, that you might wake up that spreads indeed can widen quite significantly in the context of a market dislocation.
So Sonia, we've spoken about equities, we've spoken about rates and also credit. If you were designing a portfolio right now, in terms of asset allocation, what would you be overweight? What would you be underweight?
So first and foremost, we believe diversification will play a much bigger role going forward than it has over the past couple of years. You've highlighted the well into double-digit returns that investors were able to achieve, actually with very little diversification, because it's just the S&P 500 that would have delivered this with very little volatility as well. So we should remember that you have had an extraordinary period of equity returns with very, very little volatility. Assuming that this cannot continue as is, and we've cited all the different reasons, we would like to look at a portfolio that is really trying to capture global themes and, of course, the difference in the economic cycle. We've mentioned a couple of times the preference for Europe in terms of the valuation levels in equities and actually in credit and rates. It's not just in Europe, but we look at Asia as well. And of course, we are not ignoring the US, because it will be the market that determines a lot of the other areas as well. We would look at privates as well, because it's very clear that the level of diversification you can achieve with privates in the mix, then we believe investors would be very well placed looking at this. And of course, a lot of the private market is actually supporting the global themes. If you look at the global energy transition, infrastructure, and a lot of private debt actually is required to support that transition, and we believe hence makes a lot of sense in portfolios. We are slightly underweight risk, and as we said earlier, would have a preference to underweight credit, but with a preference for Europe. Underweight US credit versus Europe, and an equity is actually quite similar, but looking for the thematic approach running through this.
Right, so a preference for Europe, both in equities and also in credit. You spoke about diversification. Do commodities provide just beta, or do they give you genuine diversification, whether you think of energy or metals?
It's very clear that commodities are the pressure valve when it comes to geopolitical events. And that's very clear, particularly when it comes to oil, because very often the impact that potential conflict has on the oil price is very immediate. And as such, we have seen in both the context of the Russia-Ukraine invasion and, of course, the conflict in the Middle East, that the oil price reacts first for very obvious reason. Now, in the medium to long term, it's supply-demand. So no commodity will dissociate itself from its own supply-demand dynamics. And as such, we have seen the oil price normalize actually on the back of both of these events. But on the day, they act as a hedge, right? You would have had a reasonable diversification benefit. And of course, commodities, not all of them to the same extent, but a lot of them play a major role in the energy transition. So you have now had an additional demand angle that has led to a lot broader interest in commodities. So we would look at this, of course, as a good addition to the portfolio.
Okay. We've done with the bulk of this interview, and we have not yet mentioned China, which would be unthinkable 2 years back or 3 years back. And that's because most investors are not very interested in China right now. Are they making a mistake? Should we be considering Chinese assets more positively than the market is?
You're absolutely right. It's been interesting to see that investors have taken quite a black or white approach to China, and the majority were actually black. So they didn't invest in China at all. We know this has not necessarily been linked to the economic performance, but mostly, of course, to responsible investment criteria, seeing a little bit more of an emotive stance towards China. And that, of course, is, you know, up to every investor to decide on how this fits into their overall value and portfolio proposition. Of course, it in hindsight felt like the right decision, because China has not done well at all, and particularly not in a global context. And we know the reasons. They have entered a very, very difficult period economically, simply because of the overinvestment in real estate, and hence a real deterioration in economic activity and a lot of debt overhang and issues to work through. China assets are cheap. Now, if you look at valuation levels in comparison to GDP growth and the like, these are cheap assets. I believe we would need to see further stabilization in the economic backdrop and a clear pathway to work through the overinvestment and, of course, the unsold homes and unfinished, you name it, right? We have all the data, so it's a relatively clear but painful path. And the question will be, at what point investors say, yes, I can see through this, and I'm happy to invest now because the upside potential is real. I believe we're getting close to that point. And this is hence when it will be very interesting whether investors will change their stance, because of course the overwhelming positives are then more difficult to ignore. But we are definitely seeing that the economy, although still not balanced, is getting to a point where, you know, we can probably look through this, and we have taken a more positive stance on this.
Can I just push back on that for just one second? Is it possible that we've lost that opportunity given how close we are to the US elections? I mean, the probability of a Republican clean sweep has gone up. So the possibility of tariffs, perhaps 60% tariffs, becomes very real. Are we losing that window of getting long China, or should we be considering that trade potentially after the elections when we get valuations at an even cheaper level?
Yes, you have, of course, the tensions between China and the US again are nothing new, right? And so there have been an overhang throughout the past 5-6 years, and the tensions were very volatile. You had sometimes more than less. The tariff threat is real, and we know it. And of course, to some extent, it will depend as well how Europe reacts to it. The US has been very clear in their intention, and again, depending on the outcome on November 5th, we might see the level of tariffs or the intensity vary a little bit, but I'm pretty sure the US is quite intent of putting these forward. In the short term, yes, it will have an impact. But, you know, economies, companies, consumers will adapt to what then the new reality is. And there's already some theories how you can circumvent these, how you potentially send your product to another friendlier country, and then you get the back door to the US. And this is this adaptation process. I don't think tariffs have a great track record of really creating the impact that was thought about at the outset. And as such, yes, it will create headlines. It will create, of course, you know, short-term volatility. But if you are a long-term investor, you are definitely looking through this because valuations are so cheap. There was a slight pickup, but it's not been a meaningful pickup in prices compared to where we've come from and the long journey down. To me, the domestic situation for the time being is more important, and the way how China can engage, of course, with Europe and the US. Europe might be even more important considering the relationship between those two countries.
Sonia, lastly, there are two markets that have done very well in APAC because China hasn't, right? But also because there have been significant policy changes within those economies themselves, not least expectations of a monetary policy change and higher inflation in Japan. So India and Japan, what do you think about risk assets in these two markets, and speaking more structurally?
You're right that in both markets, assets and asset prices have done incredibly well, justifiably so. Different reasons. India is now the fastest growing large economy in the world. Modi has been incredibly successful in providing a story and a narrative to the Indian investment case, and of course has been able to put India on the geopolitical map. That is very important because for India to continue that trajectory, and they're forecasted to be the third largest economy, I think by 2030, some are even earlier. So it is clearly a country that every investor should watch. And the election now has not been as decisive for Modi as he wished it would have been. And it's clear that he will need to focus on the domestic story as well. So I would question the timing, whether you want to invest now, because valuation levels clearly are very elevated. But we should not forget that India has not been a mainstream investment proposition, really. And it was always quite difficult to invest, actually. And looking now at the inclusion of Indian bonds into global emerging market indices, these are additional steps which make India really more investable and have the relevant structural reforms in place to make it make it easier for investors to participate. But there's been a lot of positive and even euphoria around the India story. We have seen a little bit of a setback post the election. And I think we will need to see what Modi is now planning, given that, of course, he does not have the outright majority he would have needed to just continue the pathway, and will need to make sure he collaborates with the parties that clearly have said You're ignoring agriculture. You're ignoring that a vast part of the country is not dependent on services and exporting services, but are very much agricultural based. Japan, again, very different story. And I believe has not benefited from China not doing well, but from having, of course, finally been able to see the inflationary path, you know, normalized to an extent that, of course, has not been in place for the past 30 years. It is a fragile balance. And you see from the very careful approach the Bank of Japan is putting forward is such that they do not want to disturb what is currently, you know, developing into a very positive narrative domestically as well. The consumption story and the consumers, it needs what needs to happen now, because if you look at the latest company data, that actually still looks positive. And of course, there the cheap yen plays a role. And we know that, of course, of all countries, Japan is the most sensitive to a global cyclical upswing, right? It's the highest beta by far. And you can see that, hence the corporate story is easier and more straightforward compared to the consumption story. But of course, the latest wage rounds have been very encouraging, and you might well get a very beneficial kind of circular reference that might reinforce a far more positive domestic story. And if you see that, that will be an incredible positive for Japan overall. Again, the market has priced quite a lot of this, but you needed to hedge the currency. Because if you're an international investor and you didn't hedge the currency, of course, you only had half the gain. And as such, this is very important to watch these two, because of course, we know that currently the monetary policy is not aligned with the economic one. And as such, the currency has taken the brunt of adjusting for that mismatch. But it's a fascinating story to watch. And of course, it might well be the one to invest in for the next cycle, because given that beta, if we are looking for, you know, the precarious balancing act for global growth, you might be a bit too late for that one now.
Okay, very good. So let me try and summarize, Sonia, what I've learned in this very fascinating discussion with you, right? So first and foremost, you do think that the US is slowing down and the rest of the world is coming, you know, beginning to improve from admittedly low levels, but beginning to improve. So a lot of what you're saying is informed by this rebalancing, right? So within this, there's an underweight on US bonds and US equities relative to European bonds and European equities, for instance. In an asset allocation portfolio, you'd be conservative right now. You'd be conservative in risk assets because you're worried about valuations both in bonds and in credit, but particularly in credit where valuations are at sort of close to all-time tights. We're getting close to 2005 to 2007 levels, whereas we're quite late cycle right now already. So you're taking a cautious view on credit, but again, particularly on US credit, less so on European credit. You think the long-term returns in equities, for them to be as positive as they were in the last 15 years, we're probably not going to get the same degree of help from monetary and fiscal policy, and therefore it has to be more organic. It has to be from productivity. And while you're positive on AI generating higher productivity in the future, you're perhaps not as positive as some of the most positive views in the market that you sometimes get in San Francisco or and thereabouts. Regionally, a clear preference for Europe. You're not that put off by European parliamentary elections or French elections so far. Of course, you're watching that space. Regionally, quite positive on Europe, where you are not very worried, but also regionally positive, it seems to me, on APAC, where you think investors are underestimating the kind of improvement that we can see in Chinese markets just from a leveling out as opposed to a significant pickup. And so you're more positive than the consensus on China. And in India and Japan, although tactically, you may not be chasing them because markets are already pricing in a lot. Structurally, these remain very strong investments for you. One of your key points through this interview was diversification, that we've just ridden beta, largely S&P beta, for a very long period of time. And now we really do need to diversify intelligently across all assets. And commodities will be a part of that. We need to be quite careful about how we behave in bonds as well. You think steepeners is the way to go rather than being outright long. So diversification, most important in an asset allocation portfolio. I hope that's a reasonable summary of your views.
It is indeed. And it's I think you summarized very well. And it's the nuances, of course, across regions. because it is very clear that markets have reacted very different to the backdrop that we have in the different regions.
Wonderful. Sonia, thank you so much for your time. Real pleasure to speak to you.
Great pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This content has been prepared by UBS AG, its subsidiaries and/or affiliates, and is purely informational in nature. It is not investment research and does not contain an investment recommendation, nor investment or professional advice. It is not an offer or solicitation to engage in any investment activity, and you should seek your own financial, tax, and legal advice before engaging in any such activity. UBS has no responsibility to you in relation to this content and has no regard to your personal circumstances or investment objectives, and receiving it does not imply any form of client relationship with UBS for any legal, regulatory or tax purpose. This content is not intended for distribution into any jurisdiction where to do so would be contrary to law or regulation. UBS does not accept any liability over the content of such material or reliance upon any information contained herein. The views and opinions expressed by any guest speaker or third party are not those of UBS. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over any such views and opinions expressed by such persons. This content is the valuable intellectual property of UBS, and UBS specifically prohibits the redistribution of it in whole or in part without its prior written permission. Copyright UBS, the key symbol, and UBS are among the registered and unregistered trademarks of UBS. All rights reserved.